I'm just going to do a little sort of recap on. Thanks, Andy. Do a little recap on what we've been covering so far. So we're looking at these symbols from Tantric Buddhism, and we've talked quite a lot about how a symbol is. You know, it's many dimensional. It doesn't just mean one single thing. And not only does it not just mean one single thing, the sort of meaning of a symbol will reveal itself to us more and more over time. So that's symbols in general. We're going to be spending about 10 weeks or so looking at different symbols from Tantric Buddhism. And we've been particularly looking at this one that's on the shrine, the Wheel of Life. And after the tea break I can give you your own copies for those who haven't got it. And it's very, very rich symbol, this one, and we haven't been doing justice to the whole symbol. We've just been talking about some of the main elements. And as we've been saying, strictly speaking, it shouldn't really be on the shrine at all. It's only there so we can see it, really, because it's actually the shrine's a symbol of enlightenment, and actually the Wheel of Life is a symbol for the unenlightened mind. And as Jnanavacha said the first couple of weeks, we can think of this Wheel of Life as a bit like a mirror. So what we look at when we see this symbol is our own mind. Even a mirror maybe makes it sound like something too outside of us, because this is a symbol, this is our mind actually, this is our mind as long as we're unenlightened, this Wheel of Life in the clutches of the monster of impermanence. The unenlightened mind is terrified by death and impermanence, so impermanence takes on this monstrous form. And what I was saying last week, but I'll just go over it, but it's a very, very important teaching of Sangharakshita's, and I'd really recommend the lecture Mind Reactive and Creative. You can listen to that on Free Buddhist Audio, or you can find it in anyway, Mind Reactive and Creative. It's one of those kind of really sort of pivotal lectures of Sangharakshita. And what he's saying, he's talking about these two modes of mind, reactive and creative, and he's making the point that the starting point of our dharma life isn't anything outside us. The starting point is the mind, and that it can function, it functions in these two ways. It functions reactively and it functions creatively. And the transition of our mind functioning reactively to creatively marks the beginning of our dharma life, he says. So the reactive mind is just simply our everyday kind of ordinary mind, in its kind of probably most usual mode of being. And what Bhatti says is our normal everyday mind doesn't act so much as reacts. So he says instead of acting spontaneously out of its own sort of inner fullness and abundance, it needs something external to set it in motion. And it's conditioned by something external to it. Not by merely being dependent on it, but actually determined by it. So he says the primary thing about the reactive mind is it isn't free. So when we're in that mode, we're not free, we're not acting out of just a spontaneous set of being. We're totally reliant on our surroundings, what life throws at us. That totally determines how we function when we're in that reactive state of mind. Bhante says it's not free, it's mechanical, repetitive. We talked last week about how one characteristic of our wheel is it digs ruts. So we go round and round digging deeper and deeper ruts from ourselves. It's harder to get out of the groove. I think that's the most kind of dangerous thing actually about being in this reactive state. It's not actually, it kind of gets worse. We dig ourselves deeper and deeper into the groove. I mean, we know that in our experience, I'm sure. If we keep on acting in the same habitual ways, it just gets harder and harder to change. Those patterns sort of set in. And what Bhante warns us, he says, even our dharma life can get incorporated into that routine. Yeah, so even our very dharma life can end up just being a bit mechanical. I think that's a danger. It's a danger that, in a way, almost the longer we practice. Like if you're quite new to the centre, you're kind of at an advantage in a way, because it's still always, there's a sort of freshness. There's a term called beginner's mind, you know, when it feels exciting and you're appreciative. I know when I first discovered the Dharma, this great sense of appreciation and excitement. But if you're not careful, then that can sort of settle down and just become part of the habit. Bhante says, above all, the reactive mind is the unaware mind. It's the mind that's kind of asleep. And he says that it's just when we become aware of our unawareness that the Dharma life begins, even when we begin to have a truly human existence. And so all that is represented by this wheel of life and the clutches of impermanence, the unenlightened mind. And it's driven, that whole wheel is driven at the centre, and you can come up and look more closely, of greed, hatred and delusion, represented by the pig, the cock and the snake. That's driving that wheel. That's just part of our being. You see, the thing is, as long as we're unenlightened, we will be driven by that. Well, it's almost like that's the definition of unenlightenment, as being driven by greed, hatred and delusion. So it's not so much that we're sort of born with greed, hatred and delusion, like the sort of Christian notion of original sin. It's more like we're born or reborn because of them. So because of greed, hatred and delusion, we're reborn into unenlightenment. So you can take that literally, as in literal rebirth from life to life, as it were, or you can take it just more as a moment-to-moment thing. So we're moment-to-moment, we're reborn into unenlightenment, driven by greed, hatred and delusion, as opposed to being to spiritual rebirth, which is a rebirth into a more creative mode of being. So the creative mind, on the other hand, the creative mind is represented by the Buddha. It's also represented by the spiral path, which kind of leads off the wheel of life. And the creative mind isn't dependent on or determined by stimuli from outside. It's active on its own account, sort of functioning spontaneously and freely. And sort of crucially, the creative mind responds rather than reacts. Yeah? So the creative mind is free and productive, Bhante says. The creative mind is actually contributing to the increase in the world of positive emotion, of higher states of being and consciousness. The reactive mind's just kind of tightening and tightening in on itself. It's not another thing we talked about last week. We're in that reactive state. We're just sort of circling around our own ego sense. That's all we're circling around. Whereas the creative mind is circling around something beyond ourselves. There's a sense of outward looking contribution. Yeah, there's a contribution to the world. And Bhante says, above all, the creative mind is the aware mind. They're symbolised on the one hand by the wheel of life and then the spiral path. So the key thing is this awareness. If we can be aware, then we've got a chance to respond. If we're not aware, we're just going to react in a knee-jerk way to whatever pleasure or pain we feel in life. But if we can, with awareness, we can learn to respond rather than react, and we can move from that wheel, that cyclic mode, to a spiral mode. And if we keep doing that, then eventually the sort of creative spiral mode gathers more and more momentum, so that the wheel doesn't exert a sort of pull on us. I was thinking it's a bit like that hub of the wheel. I'm mixing my metaphors drastically here, but it's like we're attached to that by a kind of string of elastic. So even if we do sort of, if we are a bit positive or even very positive, we'll sort of boing back into the middle again eventually. But what we're trying to do is like snap the elastic, so we're kind of catapulted off the wheel completely, and then we're never again sort of pulled back into it. We're pulled more by the Buddha than by greed, hatred and delusion, if you like. So that's all a kind of grand metaphor for what we're trying to do in our spiritual life, but it can be, well, I find it very useful to, well, think in those terms. Think of, if you can just remember one thing, you can think of trying to move from that reactive mode of being to a creative, responsive mode of being. So on one hand, the reactive mode characterised by not being free, being in a sort of knee-jerk reaction all the time, whereas the creative mode being characterised by a responsiveness, freedom, spontaneity, coming from an inner abundance rather than having to shore ourselves up. The wheel is my mode of we're having to shore ourselves up all the time, but the spiral, we don't need to do that, we're free. Okay, so that's just a little bit of a recap. What we're going to be doing in the second half is we're going to be looking at the last two of the six realms. There's the hub of the wheel, that's the centre circle. Then there's the next circle, the black half and the white half, that's representing the principle of karma. We've sort of covered that in earlier weeks. And now we're on the third circle, which is the six realms. And we'll briefly look at the first four that we've covered again, very briefly. But then we're particularly going to be exploring the realm of animals and the realm of human beings in the second half. And some of you hopefully will already have one of these black and white pictures. If you have got one with you, if you've already been given one, bring that in with you. If you haven't, just pick one up from the front on your way out or on your way back in. Okay. So we'll have tea for a moment. Okay, so hopefully everybody's got access to a picture at least they can look at. Sorry we ran out. Hopefully you can share. So what we're going to be doing, so this is the last week on the Wheel of Life, and we're going to be exploring the last two realms, the human and the animal realm. But I'm just going to say a little bit about the realms in general and then just briefly cover the other four in case you weren't here. So there's two ways to look at these different realms. So the realms are, I should say, so there's the heaven realm, hell realm, the Asuras or jealous god realm, the hungry ghost realm, the human and the animal. So there's two ways to look at them. So you can look at them as sort of actually sort of existing realms in the sort of in the universe, or you can look at them as states of being, states of your own mind. Although the distinction between those two isn't so hard and fast, as you say, because we do create the world with our mind. But that second way has been the way we've been exploring it. And then the other thing to say is, that's really, really important, is none of these realms are permanent. So there's the boundary between all the realms is fluid. You can move from one to the other. And also, as we saw in the first half, you can move completely out of these realms and onto what we call the spiral path. You can be you don't have to be trapped in these realms. So I'm just going to cover the four realms that we've already looked at. So starting with the hell realm, so that's the one down at the bottom. So if we look at that as a, if we look at that realm as a state of being, so who can just, so who would like to tell me what the state of being in that hell realm is? It's not hard, it's not a trick question.
Hatred,
yeah. So it's a state of, it's a realm of torment, and it's sort of the objectification of hatred, it's beings in the hell realm, their perspective would essentially be paranoid. And you know that yourself when you're in that state of hatred. I certainly know that the world looks more ugly and it feels more dangerous. You're more sort of suspicious of the world in that state. So that's the state of the hell realm. And then if you move round anti-clockwise, we come to the hungry ghost realm. That's a realm with all these beings. They've got tiny little mouths, enormous bellies, and they've got spears actually sticking out of their bellies. All the food they eat turns into daggers that then stab them. That's the hungry ghost realm. So what's the state of being in the hungry ghost realm? Craving, yeah. It's a state of always feeling that there's something missing, a feeling of inner emptiness, and a sort of trying to fill that with things that just make it worse, yeah? So that's that one. And then the one above that is the Asura realm, or jealous god. So that's, you can see they've all got swords and so on. So what is that realm? What's the state of mind of that realm?
Jealousy.
State of being jealousy, yeah. So that's the state of jealousy. And sort of competitiveness, it's the power mode state. So it's either sort of brute competitiveness, but it's any sort of manipulation. It's the power mode rather than the love mode. It's trying to get people to do what you want them to do by any means, whether that's by brute force or by a sort of more wily sort of manipulation.
Can you put pride in that category?
Yeah, you could put pride. Say a bit more of what you're thinking.
Well, just sort of jealousy is, I think it's kind of pride and ego, and if you're wanting to achieve or attain something or get, you're in that power mode, you get to the highest status, then you're potentially jealous of someone else.
Yeah.
Or your pride is jealous of someone else who you perceive has a higher status.
It's definitely jealousy. I mean, pride's interesting. I'm wondering whether you'd be aware of that pride. I think you just would feel you were the best, you know. You might not be able to recognise it as pride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The unenlightened
yeah.
mind wouldn't,
yeah. Well, you might, or even in that. Yeah, it'd certainly be competitive, it'd certainly be jealous. So maybe pride would come into it. That's interesting. In some ways, in a funny, perverse way, pride's also in that hungry ghost realm, in that inverted sense. If in the hungry ghost realm, it's probably when you feel kind of, it's the sort of pride that feels you're worse off than anyone else. And the hungry ghost, you know, that sort of pride where you feel that you're the worst and you lack. So there's a sort of inverted pride in the hungry ghost. There's certainly in that jealous gods or Asherah's realm, there is, you would stop at nothing to get on top of your neighbour in a way, to kind of be, so you do, it's certainly very driven, And then if you move around one more, then that's the god realm. So you can see, what's the state of mind of the God realm?
Bliss.
Yeah, it's a blissful state. It's quite refined, and you certainly you certainly can recognise sort of beauty and so on. You could say it's the objectification of, mind that is appreciative of beauty, even goodness. But what's the danger in the God realm?
Servitude. Yeah, servitude, like everybody's serving the guy in the centre. Everybody's serving the guy in the centre.
In the God realm you would be being served, yeah?
Sort of self-satisfaction.
There'd be a sort of complacency.
Would it be also narcissism?
Yeah, it would be. In that realm you wouldn't be aware of suffering in your own self, but also you wouldn't be able to empathise with other people. Yeah. So it's definitely not, although it's very refined and even blissful, that is not the aim of a Buddhist life. It might be a nice little stop-off point, you know. It might be, Bhante says somewhere, it's like the equivalent of a good night's sleep, you know, a bit of time in the God realm. You know, a spell in the God realm can be leave you refreshed and, you know, we do need pleasure, but you wouldn't want to get stuck there. And in each realm, you'll see that the Buddha appears in the top left corner. So just maybe we'll go in reverse order. So the Buddha brings beings in that realm, sort of remembering that when I say beings in the realm, I mean us when we're in that state of mind. What we need, the teaching that we need, yes.
I'm still not convinced that you wouldn't want to stay in that realm.
That you wouldn't want to? Yeah, well, you would want to.
You're stuck in any of them, you wouldn't be stuck in that one, then.
But you're quite right, you would want to be stuck there. That's why it's so dangerous. Because you can't be stuck there, because you can't be stuck anywhere, because everything's impermanent. It can't last. There's no permanent heaven, according to the Dharma. So you can't be stuck there. It'll run out. Your merit, as it were, will run out. So yeah, of course you want to be stuck there in a way. It is like sort of bring it on in a way, but actually you won't, you can't be stuck there. So you're going to have to, you've got to face that, yeah. So that's why, and that's why it's dangerous, because if you think you can stay there, you won't be able to, so you'll get a shock when you can't. So it's better to sort of realise yourself that you can't. So that's what the Buddha is trying to teach these beings. So who can remember what the Buddha brings to the God realm to teach them?
Music.
Yeah, so he's playing the lute of impermanence. So he's like, it's not that he's going down to their level, as it were, but he's, in a way, he's on a higher plane, giving them something they can respond to, yeah? To show them, yeah. So in a way, when we're in that God realm, we've got to remember the tune of impermanence. We've got to think, this isn't going to last. This isn't going to last, yeah. So that's what we've got to play to ourselves on our own lute, as it were. Yeah, it can't last.
Is there also a sense that the Buddha is offering something even higher than
that's
the highest that we can imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. No, that's a really good point.
Actually, there is even
more.
But if you get stuck in that, you're not going to be able to be receptive.
That's a really good point, actually. That's an ideal point. Yes, the Buddha is saying, you think this is good, but like, you haven't seen anything yet, sort of thing. You know, that this is, if you think that, because that's still in the clutches of that monster of impermanence. Yeah, that's still, there's something much, the Buddha's saying there's something much better. You can be much freer. You can be out of conditions completely. Yeah, no, thank you very much. Yeah.
What would be an example of God realm in real life?
Okay, well, I'll say this briefly, because I want to go on to the next two, but it could be, It could be being on retreat and feeling very blissed out on retreat. Yeah. So it's not negative. Yeah. So it could be blissful meditation. It could be the higher states of mind from meditation. It could be the sort of the refinement of art, beauty. Yeah. So all those things. Yeah. So they're not wrong in themselves, but there could be a cul-de-sac if we thought this is it. If we thought, oh, I've made it now. Like Akasha Mishra said, we'd close ourselves off to something that's infinitely more. Yeah. Okay, so let's just briefly, sorry to be speeding through this. So we're just going, in the Asura realm, the Buddha's bringing the sword, so that's the sword of wisdom. So again, they're all fighting with swords, so he's bringing the sword of wisdom, which is it's a much higher level, yeah. He's got a much higher sort of level of sword, as it were, yeah, that cuts through ignorance. And in the hungry ghost realm, the Buddha is bringing food and drink that actually does satisfy. So as we saw last week, that state of the tragedy of being in that state of craving is you swallow things that just hurt you even more, sort of exemplified by these knives. But the Buddha brings something that does nourish, yeah? So that's what when we find ourselves in that state of craving, we can ask ourselves, what actually truly would nourish me there? And then in the hell realm, the Buddha is bringing nectar, he's bringing ambrosia. It's the nectar of sort of immortality, yeah? So he's bringing them something very, very precious in the hell realm to sort of ease their torment. So in a way, you've got the first step of a Buddha would be to ease the torment. So that's a kind of whistle-stop tour of those four realms. As I say, if you want to go back, you can listen to much more of an exploration of them. I think those seminars were all recorded. So we're going to visit the human and animal realm this evening. And before we start, these ones are a bit more tricky in that obviously the human realm and the animal realm, we've kind of got literal examples of them in that, well, we're human beings, cats and dogs and tigers and giraffes are animals. But I don't want us to get too sort of stuck on the kind of literal. What we're looking at is what these realms symbolise, yeah? So we'll try and kind of bring ourselves back to that, because there is some overlap with the actually existent realm of humans and animals and the realms in the symbol, but there's not a kind of one-to-one complete mapping, yeah? So we've got to be a little bit more careful here. So in terms of a sort of symbolic realm, what do you think? We'll talk about the animal realm first. So what do you think? What's the state of being that would be sort of that this is trying to get at, do you think, in the animal realm?
Is it quite a base instinct?
Yeah. Can you say a bit more to what kind of...
I guess being driven by specific needs, so the need for to eat, maintain territory.
Yeah.
Quite deceptive, actually, too, isn't it? Because you've got that little leopard there, and of course, they're all friends, and like, you think you're like, okay, if I really want to eat the other guys.
Yeah, it is a bit deceptive, the picture, isn't it? Yes, I think it makes it more friendly than the animal realm actually is. You know? Yeah. It is deceptive, but yeah, I think we should have a few more of sort of eating each other and clawing each other. But yes, to come back to what Ethan says, it's that state of being in that animal realm, if we think it would be to be sort of driven by those most basic instincts, sleep, reproduction, yeah, carving out our territory. And it's almost a... Well, Subhuti, in this book that I'm reading, what's it called, The Buddhist Vision, he talks about it as quite a willful quite a willful staying in that state. Yeah, it's, I mean, obviously, like actual animals, you know, like literal animals, you know, that's just their natural state of being. That's just, you know, you could define, perhaps you could define actual animals like cats and dogs as being without self-consciousness, and human beings as having reflexive awareness. Interesting enough, just as a caveat, Buddhism doesn't make a distinct line between animals and humans. Christianity, with its notion of the soul, has got, like human beings have got a soul and animals haven't. But Buddhism wouldn't have, there'd be a more sort of movable line. You know, some animals might have more, might be more moving towards that self-consciousness, so, and human beings might be moving less towards it, yeah? So there's not such a hard line. But if you could sort of roughly say that one characteristic of a human is to have self-consciousness, then a sort of animal state of a human being is where we've sort of willfully narrowed that. We're kind of refusing to look further. We're refusing to look to any sort of higher meaning and purpose of life. And what the Buddha says is, he says it's that it's not so much in that state, it's not a state of neurosis like the hungry ghosts with that bottomless hunger. And it's not, the sort of need for things like sex and sleep and food aren't neurotic, they're healthy. But where it becomes animal-like is where they end up becoming the sole purpose of life, yeah? If our human life hasn't got any other significance, then we've kind of descended more into that animal-like realm. And interesting enough, Subhuti says in this chapter I'm reading, he says it's not necessarily that when we're in that realm that we're kind of acting in a way that's sort of stupid or unsophisticated. In other ways, we might be have very sophisticated lifestyles, yeah? We might have very kind of complex, you know, abilities. We might be operating in the world in a kind of high-functioning sort of level. We might have a very well-developed sort of practical intelligence, but it doesn't mean that we're not in this animal realm, because we're in this animal realm as soon as we haven't got any ideals, yeah? If there's nothing beyond that way of functioning, then we're kind of veering towards that more animal-like existence. So it's a life without vision, without culture. And what Subhuti says, that actually much of our modern life, even though we're kind of highly sophisticated in one way, is quite like that. So I thought I might ask you whether you agree with that or not. Do you think we live in a world that's sort of without value or without... Do you think we tend towards a world without value or vision?
Yeah?
Yeah? Yeah? Yeah. Do you want to say more? Is that...
Yeah. Well, it's just really funny that you're talking about ethics, especially in relation to, let's say, male-female interaction, because I figured out today that I'm pretty sure there's a girl at work who has a long-term partner is having an affair with a guy at work, for example, because she said she was going to be somewhere this weekend, and I know he is too.
David, Vicky, remember you've been recorded. So I think it's quite, and I'm sure these kind of things are common all the time, and also it's not all, you know, it's interesting because it's easy to see in other people, isn't it? If I think, well, where am, you know, where am I, you know, yeah.
Well, my ethics is that I don't say anything to anyone else in the office.
Yeah.
I keep that one under my hat.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sort of spiritual and religious sort of language around it. It often gets co-opted into advertising, doesn't it? Believe in better, that's the sky notion,
Yes, that's true, isn't it? Yeah. That is true. So then it's almost, yeah, it's almost kind of been hijacked, isn't it, into more completely material life. But I think that's very interesting, this point that Subhuti makes, is because sometimes you can think, if you think of like animal-like existence, I think of, oh, I don't know, lying on the couch, somebody lying on the couch with a can of beer watching the TV. But it's not, it can be much more sophisticated than that. You know, we can have a much more sophisticated life, but yet still, so it's essentially a life without vision, without value, is this animal-like existence.
It's quite useful, you know, you're saying that we don't draw the definition between ourselves and animals.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if we don't, we recognise something that we are.
Yeah.
Have that familiarity.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes it more able to recognise.
Yes, yes, and thanks for saying that. And I certainly wasn't wanting to say there's no difference, but it's just that it's not a fixed, the boundary is maybe slightly more fluid, you know.
The difference is very small, isn't it?
Well, maybe that's good, but the point, isn't it? We're closer to that animal-like realm than we perhaps realise, and it's not to say that those drives of our more animal nature, certainly there's nothing being condemned about them, but we've got to look beyond them. So what is it, can you see in the picture what the Buddha's bringing in that realm? It's hard to see actually, you probably won't be able to tell.
Is that a scroll?
It is a scroll actually, good, good, well done. So what do you think that's representing?
Wisdom.
Yeah, yeah, and sort of culture and learning and wisdom, yeah. So it's just, it's like take a step so into, yeah, something higher, something with more vision. And again, that's what we can do if we find ourselves, I mean, round about Christmas time, isn't it? They're all season, I know, but, you know, if we find ourselves in that just sort of slobbed out TV sort of state, you know, and in a way there's nothing wrong with it for a while, but we can think, okay, I need to get a bit inspired here, you know, I need to just bring something that will just raise me up a bit, yeah? Okay, so I'm not going to, I'll probably leave it at that for the animal realm, because I want to come on to the human realm, but I promised you, you may remember, you may know, that I'd bring in this other little teaching at this point. So this is another teaching related to this, which is about the Buddha seeds, okay? So the Tibetans are never short of symbols and images, and in this Tibetan Wheel of Life, there's also this teaching of the Buddha seeds. So a seed's quite a good symbol in itself, because obviously a seed is something that, well, grows, is something that needs conditions to, well, burst forth into fruition, and when it does come into fruition, well, something then exists that only existed in potential before. So each of the realms on the Wheel of Life has got these seeds, apparently, a number of seeds that can burst into fruition. And the seeds are divided into three categories. There's so-called good seeds, so-called bad seeds, and Buddha seeds. Now, the good and bad seeds, so it's not good and bad in a moral sense. It's more, you could say, for good, you could say pleasure seeds, possibly, and for bad seeds, you could see pain seeds. It's a bit more than that. It's pleasure that's come about through positive action, and it's pain that's come about through unskillful, negative action, yeah? But still, that's distinct from Buddha seeds. Buddha seeds is the sort of seeds that will germinate in enlightenment. Yeah. So each realm has got good seeds, bad seeds, and Buddha seeds. And we're going to have, I hope you'll indulge me, I thought we'd have a little just game for 5 minutes or so in trying to guess how many seeds are in each realm. And then we're going to, and that'll be, it's a game, but also it's a little teaching about the human realm. So I've got two beautiful assistants that are going to help me now. So Yi Ling and Alicia. So you can, I put three plates on the shrine with three envelopes. So you've got to come up and turn those envelopes around for a start, yeah? We won't take long on this. So turn those envelopes around so you've got bad, good seeds, right? So maybe, and then I've purloined the Dana bowl. The Dana bowl has got 36 coins in it. Oh, you've got to stay up here. They've got, one of you take the Dana bowl with 36 coins. Each coin represents a seed, and all the seeds are going to be used up, okay? Right, this is the audience participation. Right, in the God realm, how many bad, i.e. unpleasant, painful seeds do you think there are? Out of 36?
None.
Very good. There are no bad seeds, yeah? How many good seeds do you think there are?
Loads.
Okay, there are loads. Actually, maybe I'll make it easier. How many Buddha seeds do you think there are?
None.
Four. Apparently, according to this tantric teaching, I don't know how they get this figure, but you're all very close. There's three Buddha seeds. So if you put three Buddha seeds in the God realm, they look like pound coins. They're seeds. But just imagine a seed. Okay. And how many? And all the rest. He put all the rest. You like put all the rest on the good. On the good, yeah. So keep all the rest on the good plate. Yeah? So that's interesting. There can't be any Buddha seeds, although there's a lot of pleasure seeds, yeah. So that's quite interesting. That's illustrative of pleasant doesn't always mean positive, yeah? I think as we drew out earlier. So actually the God realm, from a point of view of attaining to Buddhahood, you know, it's not, you don't want to get stuck there, because you could get placed in, you could be in a cul-de-sac for a long time, yeah? Okay, tip all the seeds back in the bowl. Please.
What's a Buddha seed?
So Buddha seed is the seed that will grow into enlightenment. Yeah? So the jealous gods are the Asherahs, okay? How many good or pleasant seeds do you think are in there?
None.
Any advances on none?
Six.
One. Well, you might be surprised, but apparently there's about 12 good seeds in there, so stick 12 on there. Yeah, but I've got a little picture of them here. Yeah. Okay, so hang on, give me your attention, please, everyone, while they're doing this. So how many bad seeds while they're doing that? How many unpleasant? How painful is it to be in that jealous realm? Think of jealousy, sexual jealousy. How painful is it?
24.
Yeah, okay, 20 bad seeds. How many does that leave? Who's good? We've got 12 good, 20 bad. Or, yeah, actually, I haven't made a mistake. Actually, there's 22 bad seeds, and there's only one Buddha seed, yeah? So you do not want to be in that. So that's in, so when you're in that jealous power mode state, when you're in the power mode state, that's the worst place to be, yeah? It's going to be really hard to get enlightened if you're in the power mode, yeah?
Does it say what the seeds are? Counting units, or do they say the
CDs? Well, that's just the categories, good, bad, or Buddha. So that's what they're going to.
It doesn't say what it is that you might find in that realm that might make you.
Well, that's what it's going to grow as, you know. So basically, if you stay in that jealous.
There's no metaphor for the seed.
The seed is a metaphor. So if you're in that jealous realm and you stay in it, what will flower will be more pain. Yeah?
Well, my question is, if they say there's 12 seeds, it's not that one would be jealousy, the other one would be greed.
No. So you're in the jealous God realm, yeah? If you stay in that state of jealousy and power mode, what will flower will be pain. Yeah? A heap of pain. A little bit of pleasure, and very little chance of Buddhahood from that realm. So you're going to... You could attain Buddhahood from that realm, but you're going to have to get out of that realm.
But the question was, they're not assigning attributes to each of the seeds.
No, it's just a general... Just general. I'm sure you could. I'm sure there'd be different katas, different... You could refine the pain, yeah. So... Okay, assistants, if you can tip them back again. Everybody else give me your attention. So how does ghost realm, when you're in that state of craving, nothing will satisfy you. How pleasant is that? Is it
not
pleasant? Okay, there's no positive in that. Okay, so how many Buddha seeds do you think are in that realm?
Quite a few.
Yeah. Okay, so apparently there's 8 Buddha seeds. So I think that's quite interesting because I think in that state, although you're looking for the wrong thing to satisfy you, there is a sense of search. There is, I mean, we know that. I think it's, you know, if we do feel craving, even addicted, there's a sense of we know there is something more, but we're just looking in the wrong place. So actually, there's some sort of longing for something higher in that state of craving, yeah? But it's not very... You've got 8 Buddha seeds, tip all the rest on the bad, because it's not a very pleasant place to be, yeah? There's a lot of pain, yeah? In there, yeah. Okay, so maybe you could just... You don't need to tip them all back, you can just do a little bit of swapping around there. In the hell realm, is there any pleasure?
No.
Okay. How about Buddha seeds in the hell realm? Think there's any Buddha seeds?
Well,
quite a few. Not a lot, but there's a few. So apparently there's 9 Buddha seeds, so you can stick one in there. So there's a few because in that realm, when you're so desperate, sometimes there's only one place you can go, yeah? On the other hand, there's not loads, because when you're in torment, it can be really hard to act skillfully, yeah? Mm-hmm. We know that ourselves. When you're absolutely consumed with pain, it can be very, very difficult to think bigger, yeah? Mm-hmm. So there's not loads, yeah? Okay, what about the animal realm? So, now even though you've got this nice picture of the animals all skipping around playing with each other, as our friend pointed out here, the animal realm isn't really such a pleasant place, is it? There's much more fighting and killing than that picture depicts. So if you take that into account, how many pleasant seeds have been in the animal realm?
There might be a couple.
Well, two, yeah. We've only got 3 here in our tantric teaching, wherever it came from. So put 3. Apparently there's 7 Buddha seeds. Don't know. That's quite amazing, really, isn't it? 7 Buddha seeds in the animal realm, and all the rest is bad, painful, painful place to be in the animal realm. Nature, red and tooth and claw and all that. Okay? Okay, so... In the human realm, this is all serving a purpose, hopefully this. In the human realm, you've got 36 seeds, okay? You're going to divide them between good, as in pleasure, bad, as in pain, and then Buddha seeds, as in potential for enlightenment. How would you divide these seeds?
33 and a third each way.
Yeah, exactly. They're completely evenly divided, yeah? Brilliant. So they're completely evenly divided. Yeah, 12 in each, in fact. Okay, thank you. So brilliant. Thank you, beautiful assistants. So hopefully... I don't know what people on the recording are making of this, but all you need to know is that... So now, beautiful assistants, when you've done that, you can take your seats again, yeah?
Something like that.
Yeah? Thank you very much. We'll put the money back on the dining board later. So hopefully, yeah, there's some teaching in there. There's some teaching in... Well, basically, this, if you just remember one thing, remember for a Dharma life, the human realm is the best place to be. But you can't assume that you're in the human realm just because you've got a human form. You can be in any of these realms, hell, hungry ghost, asura realm, animal realm. So we want to be in the human realm because in the... Well, what, you could ask yourself, what makes a human being a human being? And you could say that in respect to these other realms, in the human realm, we've got a balance of pleasure and pain. So it's interesting that we need both. Why do we need both? What would happen if it was all pleasure? I mean, we've kind of had the answer, really. What was that? We'd get complacent. And what would happen if it was all pain? What would the danger be?
Despair.
Yeah, we'd feel overwhelmed, we'd feel despair, yeah? So we need enough pleasure to actually, well, help us to aspire, yeah? But not, and a little bit of pain, not too much, not to be overwhelmed, but to make us healthily discontent with being on this wheel, and also to give us empathy with the pain of others, yeah? So we need a balance of pleasure and pain, and then we need a balance of what we call, I'll use the Buddhist words here, karma and karma vipaka, yeah? So karma is action, vipaka is the fruit of action. In all the other realms, we are just, in a sense, bearing the fruit of our action. So in the state of the more tortured realms, we're bearing the fruit of unskillful action. In the heaven realm, we're bearing the fruit of skillful action. But in none of these realms really is there the perspective or awareness to be to be creative, be responsive, like we were talking about before. So we need to be in a position to be able to respond and create fresh kind of karma, not just be stuck in reaping the effects, yeah? So all this is the sort of prerogative of being in a truly human realm. And according to traditional Buddhism, it's really rare to be in this realm, yeah? So we find ourselves in this realm. We really want to make the most of it. It's precious because it's got the capacity for enlightenment, yeah? So you could, according to some teachings, you could put, rather than that, the human realm being sort of just one of the six realms, you could put it kind of almost a bit higher. You could put it centrally and a bit higher, yeah? So... because we've that balance of pleasure and pain, that balance of karma and karma vipaka enables us to have a sense of perspective. That's why you put it higher. So in the other realms, you kind of tend to be more obsessed with the experience that you're in and identify with that. We know ourselves, when you're in that hell realm, you can't see out of it. You know, when you're in that craving, you've got no perspective. That, by definition, you haven't got perspective. As soon as you've got perspective, you're in the human realm again. And in the human realm, we might experience those states, but we're not identified with them. You've sort of got a balance and a breadth of perspective. You don't kind of overgeneralize from your current experience. That's what we tend to do in those other states. You know, you wake up in the morning, you're in a bad mood or something, you think, oh no, that's it, the day's ruined, or the week's ruined, or my life's ruined, don't you? You've kind of got, you haven't got perspective. So it's not just the state itself, it's you're then generalising, this is going to last forever. Actually, the same with those more blissed out states as well, that's why they're doing, you think, oh, this is it, I made it, I'm somebody, I'm something. You know, you overgeneralise from your current experience, whereas in the truly human realm, you've got perspective to see, okay, I'm here because of certain conditions, this won't last, and not only that, I have got some power to make creative choices that can help me to transform this state, yeah? You've got, and that, in a way, that when we talk about Buddhist ethics, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about that ability to sort of, to choose, yeah? Is there any, I've got a few more things I want to say, but does that make sense, that the idea of the truly human realm being a realm that's kind of got that perspective? It's almost a bit, it's, you could almost put it on a different plane than the other realms.
Mm-hmm. How would you link that to meditation?
Well, what do you think yourself?
I'm thinking that through meditation, you sort of see more clearly what your situation is and sort of where you are on the wheel. And you may be just sort of in different places, different times then.
Yeah.
Being able to see that.
Yeah, but that's exactly it. And that's perspective, isn't it? And that's, like Jnanavajra was saying in the tea break, that's the kind of awareness and perspective. That's the real meaning of meditation. Or certainly a deeper meaning than meditation than, you know, say for example, simply meditating in order to experience a bit more calm or a bit more kind of positivity. A deeper meaning of meditation is to have that perspective, to see more clearly, well, where am I and what step do I need to take next? Yeah. So it's exactly it. Yes, Brian?
Also, for me it's interesting because it helps me see some of the other people I've got maybe issues with.
Yeah.
And maybe they're in some of these other states.
Yeah.
It's quite difficult, you know. We all know quite a few people who are very controlling one another.
Yeah.
And that can have a negative effect on them.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it gives a bit of perspective on other
people. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And maybe a bit more empathy. Certainly, that Buddha would look at all these, you know, would just look at all these states as states of suffering. wouldn't be sort of triggered off by them or so on, but on our level it can give us just a bit more empathy and maybe even think, oh, well, what do they need in that state? Like you think, well, what's the Buddha bringing? Well, could I bring something?
Also, it sounds like from what you're saying that the human realm does have a certain amount of freedom from these other states. However, because it's on the wheel, I'm assuming it's not really enough freedom to not be able to then go into the sun of the other states. So it's not like you're actually completely free because you could, you know, you could go back, you could go to any of these other states.
You could actually, yeah.
Because you haven't kind of become free enough.
You could. And that's why when we find ourselves in the human state, you know, both in the actual physical human state, you know, but also in a kind of truly human state, which is freedom from any of these other ones, we should really, really make the most of it when we're in it. So what does the Buddha bring, if you think, is it clear enough on the picture, can you see what the Buddha is bringing in the human state? What's he carrying? A lantern. It looks a bit like a lantern, but it's not a lantern. It looks a bit like a plant as well, but it's not a plant. It's tiny, the picture, isn't it? It's actually a begging bowl and a staff, yeah? So it's a begging bowl and a staff. So what do you think this is symbolising, the bowl and the staff?
Humble.
The spiritual life.
The spiritual life, yeah. So that's what that's... It's, and it's in a way, it's, that's a direct response to what we're saying here. When you find yourself in the human realm, it's like, cherish that. Don't get complacent, but think the next thing to do is practice the Dharma. You know, so whether that's literally taking up a bag of bone staff, probably not for most of us, but practice the Dharma. Realise that this may not last. Any moment we could fall into one of these other realms, again through our mental states, but also, you know, all the time we're trying to think of these realms in two ways. They're our own states, but, you know, they could be objectively existing states as well. So, for example, the hell realm, as well as being a mental state, you know, there are actually existing very hellish, you know, states of, you know, with wars and famines and so on. At any moment that could happen. Obviously it's not impossible to practice with all that sort of oppression, but much, much more difficult. So when we find ourselves in a state where we're not in any of those other realms, and also we've got, well, all the benefits that we've got by living in a country such as ours that isn't directly at war, you know, we're not under religious oppression, you know, we've got enough to eat and drink on the whole, we've got enough health to actually get to the Buddhist centre at least, even if we're not in perfect health, we've got ourselves here. Any of that could go at a moment's notice, you know. So, the teaching is really make the most of it. Value that it's rare. I mean, we so often just take it for granted, so many of these things, but value the rarity of it.
When I speak to a lot of Buddhists, I find that the idea of freedoms, which you're talking about, you can buy a certain amount of them, buy money, you can buy healthcare and such like.
Okay.
There's a limitation to the amount you can buy. You can only buy one house.
Yeah.
You can only live in one house, you can buy 10. After a certain while, the difference doesn't get so noticed. And there's a financial cut-off point for how much money you can make, you can afford it. But I find, when I spoke to a lot of Buddhists from sheltered backgrounds, found this degree of ignorance where people talk about, you know, we talk about environments that people are in, and the ability to maintain good judgment within one position is very different to a different one, you know. And it's quite interesting, because you have to be able to appreciate the circumstance for the circumstance to actually be something. But people from end up buying themselves different distractions. You look at higher level celebrities or other people, they end up buying into something else when they've got those freedoms.
Well, I think again, I think that appreciation is the key, isn't it? That we can stop and just, in a way, notice what we have, but more than just, as I'm emphasising, more than notice it, actually make the most of it. Yeah. So is there anything else? We've got about 5 minutes. Is there anything else on the human realm? Yes.
Can you say a bit more about the stream entrance? Or how you access?
Okay. So the stream entrance, for some, which is very relevant here, and I'll just define the term for people that don't know. So a stream entrance is the... Well, again, it's a metaphor. The metaphor is of... I'll come back to the metaphor... But the definition of a stream entrant is when your practice has gained so much momentum that you're no longer driven by greed, hatred and delusion. You'll still feel the pull of greed, hatred and delusion. You're not completely free of it, but that won't be driving you anymore. So it's a point where your spiritual dharmic momentum has reached such a point that there's no longer any falling back. You know, I was saying earlier on, it's like we're on this elastic that pulls us back to greed, hatred and delusion. You could say stream entrance when we've broken the elastic, or at least when it's gone the way, you know, I don't know, you know, when it's lost its stretch, it can't pull us back. And the metaphor of entering the stream is, first in our Dharma life, it's as if we're rowing against the current. It's hard work. We've got to really make an effort. There's so many forces we're working against. so we're rowing against the current, but then eventually we enter the middle of the stream and we're more easily swept along. So at stream entry, we'll still we'll still be making an effort, but the effort will be easy to make because it would kind of go against our nature to make an effort. So it won't really feel like effort. That is what's very, very important, that we know that that's a possibility. So it's not enlightenment yet, but from that point we're more pulled by the Buddha, you could say, than pulled by greed, hatred and delusion. And Sangharajita Bhante, our teacher, has been very clear to say that he thinks that that is a possibility for anyone seriously practicing the Dharma in their lifetime, for their practice to reach that point of that momentum, that there's no longer falling back. And yeah, until that point you can always fall back into any of these realms, and you could fall back, and then that's very dangerous because there might be so much sort of oppression from within your own mind and outside that practice becomes much, much more difficult. Yeah, but a stream entry, no matter what happened, you know, you would always be able to find a creative response. You wouldn't be dependent on conditions anymore. Okay, any last questions? There's just time for one more question, or maybe someone who hasn't asked a question. Yes?
Hi. This is a bit random, but okay. You're saying how in a lifetime you can achieve enlightenment.
Yeah.
So I've sort of wondered, you know, is there anyone at present who has achieved that enlightenment? And most people sort of like, no, I don't think so. I did once meet this Buddhist, and he was saying there's someone called Amma or something in India, and I just wanted to know if you thought this person, if you've heard of this person, and whether this person has achieved this enlightenment, because she's apparently got this reputation that she's actually achieved.
Well, I've not heard of this person, but it's certainly, I mean, I'd be very, very disappointed and surprised if there weren't people who had realised enlightenment, and certainly this point that we talked about earlier, stream entry, you know, it's very... It's going to be impossible to know for sure, because you need to know somebody over a long time, and even oneself, you would, in a way, you wouldn't. Well, basically,
what do you mean? You need to know someone for a long time.
Because
surely if someone's a Buddha, you'll recognise them instantly.
Oh, you might not. Lots of people didn't recognise the Buddha. Yeah, they just kind of thought, oh yeah, so, yeah. Lots of people didn't. Yeah, so you need to know them, but also you'd need to, because of this metaphor that I've just invented about the elastic, you know, somebody could be manifesting very positive qualities for ages, even years, but it could be that hadn't been tested. So you need to know that even when it was tested against very, very difficult circumstances, they were still able to remain positive, buoyant, creative. So you need to know that, you know. So you need to know somebody over a long time to know that. But, well, what I can say is two things. One, that I definitely know people that I look up to as always seeming to be very positive and very creative, that I've known for a long, long time. So I certainly know that there are people whose dharmic momentum is very strong, even if I can't know for sure that it's irreversible. And I certainly know myself on a much, much lower level that I have changed since I've started to practice, and I see that it doesn't, if I keep practicing, I've got faith that that will continue, that change. So I can see those two things, so that gives me faith and confidence that it is possible as a living reality, because if it wasn't, well, in a way, then the Dharma wouldn't be true. You know, the Dharma quite clearly tells us that this is, you know, in a way, sort of, yeah, I would certainly have confidence that it would be, but I wouldn't like to, at the same time, I wouldn't like to say, well, him, her, you know, in a way, it's more of a general principle. Yeah. Okay, so I think we'll have to wind up there. So next week we're going on to another symbol, which is, who's going to remind me from the team? Which one is it? Can't remember, but anyway, so now that's another one which Dai Bhadra is going to be teaching. I think it might be the Vajra next week, yeah. So, yeah, thank you all, and I hope you found that Wheel of Life teaching helpful. Thank you.